You're listening to a sponsored episode of The Top Line.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. You're listening to The Top Line, brought to you by Fierce Biotech. And I'm your host for today, Chris Hayden. I'm a producer here at Fierce. Today, I'm joined by Olive McCormick. She's the Director of Quality at AllMac Clinical Services. And as a Director of Quality and a qualified person at AllMac Clinical Services, Olive is responsible for quality assurance, quality control, and the regulatory compliance in the UK and Ireland. Olive's expert knowledge, deep understanding of quality procedure has established her as a thought leader in the industry. So, Olive, first of all, welcome.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be part of the podcast.
Of course, of course. I would love it, Olive, if you could just tell us a little bit about what your role involves.
Okay, so I joined AllMac back in 1998, so a few years ago. And over the years, I've gained extensive experience really in all things relating to IMPs. In my current role, I have the privilege of leading teams that manage and oversee our pharmaceutical quality system. And I also have had keen interest in the review and interpretation of global regulatory requirements. And in more recent years, I have guided AllMac through the implementation of several major regulatory changes. And I believe that all of that and all of that experience together has really shaped how I approach quality, compliance, and I guess leadership within a global environment.
Yeah, I love that you've been at this since 1998, the changes you must have seen, Olive, through your time.
So this is a fascinating conversation. I'm looking forward to diving in today's podcast episode. The podcast today is called Navigating the New Clinical Trial Regulation in the United Kingdom. And in today's episode, we're going to discuss some of the most significant reform to the UK clinical trial legislation in over 20 years. So on April 28th, 2026, the new UK clinical trial regulation comes into force, introducing changes that will shape how sponsors manage their clinical trials, including considerations such as labeling, non-investigational medicinal products, and ongoing trial modifications as well. We're going to provide some examples of what these changes mean in practice, and most importantly, explore how sponsors will adopt these new requirements to help them remain compliant. So whether you're in clinical operations, quality, supply chain, regulatory affairs, this episode will inform you and help you prepare for the transition with confidence. Now, Olive, I understand you are heavily involved in helping sponsors interpret these changes, and you bring a wealth of expertise in quality and compliance-related matters. So I would love it if you could kind of set the scene for us, if you could. What is the new UK clinical trial regulation? Why was it introduced? And what was the MHRA trying to achieve with it?
So if we look back over the past few years, a pivotal point was really Brexit. When the UK exited the European Union back in January 2020, and instantly at that time point, the MHRA became the UK's standalone regulator for clinical trials. I guess back in the driving seat, responsible really for shaping the UK's clinical trial regulations from the ground up again. And that shift wasn't just about breaking away from the EMA or EU processes, because prior to that, the MHRA had heavily invested in the development of the EU regulatory framework and were actually quite influential in that regard. However, it was more about, firstly, seizing the opportunity to design a regulatory framework that was sufficiently agile to keep a pace with the evolving demands of research and innovation, but was really patient safety and the need for greater transparency at the forefront. Secondly, I would say it was also being viewed by the MHRA as an opportunity to halt the decline in clinical trials that was evident in the UK, and indeed even wider in the EU, with a view to increasing the volume of trials conducted, and to strengthen the UK's position and make it as an attractive place for sponsors to get clinical trials up and running much more quickly.
That sounds ambitious. How likely is it that the regulation will deliver on that vision?
I know it's fairly ambitious, but what we're really seeing from the regulation is a very deliberate shift. And at the heart of that, their intent to adopt a more balanced, risk-proportionate approach to their review of applications. They've introduced a new streamlined process to what they identify as low-risk trials, or notifiable trials, as they call them, allowing them to really commence at speed, and in doing so, freeing up their experts' time to focus on the more complex, high-risk, novel products, but reducing unnecessary delays and making sure the UK remains, you know, competitive and appealing destination for the trials. And I guess the output of that, or the byproduct, really means that both sponsors and patients benefit. You know, sponsors are able to get their trials sooner and patients have access to promising treatments as quickly, as safely as possible. What I would say is what surprised many in the industry wasn't really about what has changed. I know it's been hailed as a significant reform, but it's really the speed of the implementation period. When I reflect on it, Chris, it was signed into law on the 28th of April, 2025. And here we're sitting just a few weeks shy of when it enters into force just exactly 1 year later. So that's quite an achievement.
You know, the implementation timeline is relatively short, especially when we're talking the timeline for bringing these drugs to market. So how has the industry responded to that pace of change?
I think, first of all, the implementation timeline speaks volumes in the fact that it sends another very clear signal from the MHRA of their intent to react with speed. You know, you asked there, Chris, how has industry responded? And speaking from Almac's perspective, we immediately established a global change team with representatives, experts from a wide range of functions within Almac. And having all the right stakeholders involved from the very onset was particularly important to sit down and review the regulation together and begin to assess the changes, you know, consider how it might impact our clients, what we could do to help them prepare. And I have to say that that line-by-line review is a pretty tedious exercise, but there's no substitute for it. It's essential to be able to work through, you know, the various scenarios, brainstorm the potential impacts, document our thoughts and interpretation. And I have to say, it wasn't just a one and done, because we had to revisit that regularly in the months that followed as the MHRA really released a series of supplemental guidance documents providing clarity on many of the topics that was raising some questions.
And what was your engagement like with sponsors during that time?
Well, I suppose maybe even taking a step back, during that period, we engaged with hundreds of clients on a number of levels, starting off with high-level comms to them initially, because some of them are quite far removed and maybe wouldn't have been as close to the regulation. And that was really to alert them, you know, the new regulation and changes are coming. What we really found initially was that the feedback was particularly slow. And as a result, we felt that it was necessary, you know, to nudge a little more and to apply a sense of urgency in the matter, given the tight timelines and that there was action required. And consequently, we sent out further comms and every opportunity we could to weave it into the business review meetings, regular study meetings. And I guess as a major player in this space, Almac also had a degree of foresight into what the sponsors may find particularly challenging. You know, what might they be most concerned about or what might be open to interpretation? And it was quite telling, really, because in the months that followed, the questions then started to filter in and we were able to build a catalogue of frequently asked questions, prepare some standard responses and try to ensure a consistent message. And it wasn't then long before the hot topics started to emerge. In an effort sort of to get ahead of the game, we were able then to positively engage with the MHRA, provide them with greater visibility of the key issues that we were hearing from the larger industry and share with them how we were planning to deal with these. And their reaction was quite telling as well, and also unprecedented in the fact that they updated a number of the guidance documents with significant speed, dealing with those most prevalent issues and I guess putting many at ease, or at least not giving them the answer they want, at least putting them in a position whereby they had clarity and knew how to go forward.
I would love to hear, you know, from your conversations with different sponsors around the region, what's kind of emerged as the key hot topics that you've been hearing about?
So considering the breadth of the regulations and the guidance documents, which really included everything from, you know, your start-off place, how to apply to conduct the clinical trial, right to the end regarding what to do at the end of a study, the sponsor queries raised were really centred around a few key areas with particular concerns around the transitional arrangements, what new information was to appear on their product labels, and the additional requirements for non-investigation of industrial products that we commonly refer to as NIMPs. And if I was to put it quite simply, they really centered around, what do I need to do to ensure my ongoing trials are unaffected? How do I manage the updates to my clinical labels? And what action do I do to take with regard to NIMPs? And almost every question that was directed at Almac has been tactical and operational in nature, really focusing on the here and now to ensure ongoing trials could transition uninterrupted without impacting their patients.
So I'd be curious to hear, you know, starting with these transitional arrangements, what's the most important clarification sponsors need to understand here?
Firstly, maybe I should clarify a few points that require no action, because that's always good news. Firstly, unlike the EU CTR that came into full force in 2025, there is no need to resubmit your trial under the new regulatory framework. So this means that if you have an existing UK clinical trial, it can continue to operate as long as it complies with the new labelling rules from the 28th of April 2026. So I guess the most obvious question out of that is, what if your trial does not comply with the new labelling rules? And one particular point to note is that IMPs that have been manufactured and QP certified before that deadline, what I keep referring to, the 28th of April, they can continue to be used in the clinical trial. So if you've product that's labelled within the UK that is already being QP certified, there is no issue. You know, you can continue to use that material without restriction. And if at a later time point, you also need to expiry update that material, which is often the case in the IMP world that we live in, that can also proceed without issue. Another key point that they had highlighted in their updated guidance was that if you have product to be imported from an approved country that has already been certified by an EUQP, again, before that deadline, it can continue to be verified after this date by the UK QP responsible for the importation oversight. And I said at the beginning there, these are the things that you have to do nothing about. So those particular points being clarified in the updated guidance was really helpful. However, what it really does mean is that IMPs manufactured, so you could have IMPs products produced that haven't yet been QP certified before the deadline, they cannot be used if they don't comply with the new rules. And that's the important message. And in light of that, really, sponsors need to perform an impact assessment to really come up with a solid plan of action. And I guess on a practical level, you might decide to expedite your QP certification before the deadline if that's within your gift. You know, do whatever you need to do to be able to continue. Otherwise, you have to restrict its use and only to use in the countries where it can otherwise be used, or worst case scenario, relabeled your product. So the message really is there are options, but knowing the status of your inventory is key, as all of those scenarios I've just mentioned there takes careful planning to minimize the impact.
Any words of caution?
If I was to issue a word of caution and all of that, it would be don't forget about product not yet imported into the EU or the UK. And if you allow me, Chris, to explain, if I take an example, if as part of your supply chain, you had product that was packaged and labelled in the US. So for example, you had material that you packaged and labelled at our Almack facility in Pennsylvania, and you made a batch of 2,000 patient kits. And you may have imported and QP certified 1,000 of those kits before the 28th of April for use in the UK, and that's fine. However, if you decide at a later time point, you know what, I need to import a further 500 from the same batch of product after the 28th of April. The message is that they cannot be used in the UK unless those labels comply, because they have not been imported and certified before the deadline. And that's an area that could really catch people out. And know that my response is probably, you're listening, Chris, and you're saying it's very focused on labels and transition arrangements from a couple of the areas. And I don't want to give the impression that that's all that matters. However, I'm also very mindful of the fact that right now that's what sponsors are most concerned about. But maybe on that note, another guidance document that needs careful consideration is the one for non-investigation medicine products. That is what we call NIMPs, as some of the pragmatism I've just described there in relation to IMPs is certainly not the same when it comes to NIMPs.
And NIMPs do seem to be an area that could catch companies out, as you said. So what has changed around that?
Maybe just for the sake of the audience, you should first of all start to clarify what a NIMP is. In case it's an abbreviation for a non-investigation medicine product, which is really a medicinal product that is used or to be used as part of your clinical trial. It's described in your protocol, but it's not the product that's under investigation. And just as a term of reference, they're referred to in the EU as auxiliary medicinal products or AXMPs.
Could you give us an example?
If I give an example, it would be rescue medication that is to be included as part of your protocol, maybe to manage an anticipated emergency situation. So let's imagine your clinical trial is on a new biotechnology product that's to be given to humans for the first time. In that case, the protocol requires the availability of appropriate medicinal products needed for the treatment of anaphylactic shock. So that's probably a good example of what a NIMP is. And really, the new regulations then clarify how the NIMP should be sourced and labelled for UK clinical trials. And with the most recent update, the MHRA have clarified that there are no transitional arrangements in place for NIMPs, and that is the one issue that could certainly catch companies out. Previously, the guidance with regard to NIMPs was extremely limited, and although some sponsors may have labelled these to ensure they were linked to the trials, the approach wasn't standardised at all. And so you can imagine now, no transitional arrangements, sponsors really need to react and do something about it.
So what steps should sponsors take right now to ensure compliance?
The guidance document really gives them the advice as to what they need to do. So it tells them they should either submit a new NIMP label that is compliant and ensure that it's applied and used on all of their product after the 28th of April, or if for some reason it is not possible, then they must submit a request to vary or disapply those new labelling requirements. And this is viewed as a substantial amendment. And the important thing is that time is not on their side, because really sponsors must justify the reasons for that variance and do so at least 35 calendar days before the 28th of April 2026. So a lot has to be done in a very short period of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, keeping that in mind, Olive, I'd love to hear kind of what practical steps should sponsors be taking now to de-risk ongoing and future UK trials?
I would say the single most important thing is to know the regulation and the guidance documents. You know, there's no substitute for it, really. And understanding the requirements and the extensive nature of the changes is essential, because only then can you determine the impact and what I need to do to take action. At a very practical level, it's the basics of good change control within your organization, you know, in order to execute a systematic review and undertake the tasks. And, you know, I described how ALMAC was doing it earlier. You know, having all the right stakeholders involved is essential, really, to assess the impact and come up with a plan. And to de-risk, it shouldn't always be about or only be about dealing with the here and now. It should also be about thinking, how might this impact our ways of working and our strategic decisions going forward? And we've seen some great examples in recent months of companies who have done this exceptionally well and involved ALMAC at a strategical and tactical level. However, on the other hand, there are definitely sponsors who are just getting started on that journey.
What would your advice be for sponsors to focus on right now?
If I was to advise on a few key areas where sponsors should be focusing right now, I would say, number one, labels. Like, do your labels on your IMPs and the NIMPs comply. And the second, I guess, is product. What release or import needs expedited, or what needs reworked? Third, I would say, is your clinical trial application. You know, what amendments or modifications are required? And last but not least, planning. For example, what new packaging operations do I need to schedule? And my final words of advice would really be, do the executives within your organization know about the changes that's coming? Definitely leaders want to know the risks, certainly don't want to meet up with any surprises at the 11th hour that could jeopardize their trial, the patients, the company, or their reputation. So it's definitely a call to action.
Absolutely. Everybody has to be working from the same page, you know?
100%, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's fascinating.
Well, Olive, thank you so much for helping us through this topic. Really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yes, of course. Always nice to chat with somebody from Ireland. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of The Top Line. Once again, I'm your host, Chris Hayden. And as always,
that's the bottom line from The Top Line.